Good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, March the 8th, 2016, 1:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. In this hour, we're going to remember broadcasting great Ohio native legendary tennis broadcaster Bud Collins, who sadly passed away last Friday at the age of 86. Today we're going to remember him. We're going to hear some clips from interviews that I did with Bud over the years. Hopefully during this hour we're going to be joined by his widow, Anita Ruthling Clausen. And we're going to learn the insides of a man who really put tennis on the map as far as broadcasting goes, and all the years he wrote for the Boston Globe and really kept tennis on the map. He was on this program a lot of times over the years. We just played an interview of Bud's from Christmas Eve of 2008, and it was always a joy to have Bud Collins on the program. Those loud pants and everything that made him one of the greats. Very unique voice, very unique person. Dick Enberg, for so many years, was his partner on NBC for the Wimbledon games. And Dick Enberg has sent some message to honor his friend Bud Collins. And here we go, Dick Enberg.
Well, sad news today. We lost a giant voice in sportscasting, a very close friend and colleague. He wrote the The man was the encyclopedia of tennis. Bud Collins, game, set, match. Dead at 86. A man that will be sorely missed.
And he was one of a kind. There's no doubt about that. There have been some other tributes played to Bud that I want to get to here. From some of the all-time greats in the tennis world.
He was not just your cut and dry black and white journalist. He grew up with the players. You know, we grew up with him and he grew up with us.
His wardrobe designer must be an escapee from an insane asylum somewhere.
Not only is he colorful in what he wears, he's just colorful in personality. Now, he's a real celebrity in our sport and he's earned it, believe me.
Remember, he is the most knowledgeable person in the history of tennis.
He is an historian. He's an ambassador. He's a great writer, great commentator. He is kind of the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John of tennis.
He was an educator. He took a country, so little of which knew about tennis, and he said, no, come on, I'll tell you all about it.
His intrinsic knowledge of the game just gave him a dimension that nobody else had or still has to this day.
He held the game together. The game held his life together year after year after year. He helped bring the game alive.
There ought to be a whole wing in his honor at the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
I know they do say clothes make the man, but in this case, I think the man made the clothes.
My name is Arthur Worth Collins Jr., but everybody calls me Bud.
He's a terrific writer. Terrific historian, but most importantly for me, he's a very, very, very dear friend, and I love him very much.
Bud had great empathy. Win or lose, you were okay about talking to him because he would make you feel better.
But as soon as I went over and I knew Bud Collins was going to interview me, and I saw those pants, then my life brightened up.
You know, Bud was the premier historian of the sport. He was the premier writer of the sport, and he was also the leading guy in television.
Of all the announcers that we had, Bud was always, for NBC, the face of tennis.
Tennis had the reputation of being a gentleman's game and the white outfits and even the white ball, and Bud comes along and tried to shake that world a bit with his personality, and it was a game plan for him to say we could be different in tennis too.
He was really a pioneer in that sense. I don't think anybody else could have done it. He was a journalist stepping into the television booth who also was in love with tennis, so it was a pretty good combination. Worked beautifully.
He is the most passionate lover of the sport, but he's been that for 60 years. It didn't just happen. I mean, he always loved to play tennis, to write about tennis, to broadcast tennis, and to be friends of tennis people.
They ought to have a big statue for Bud Collins somewhere. I don't know quite where he would like it to be placed, but tennis owes him that kind of honor because he's done as much for the sport as any single player has. We all should stand and applaud.
Bud Collins, certainly one of a kind, and if many don't know, Bud Collins was born in Ohio. An Ohio boy, for people who didn't know. Bud Collins was famous for his interviews, you heard a little bit of it there, after the match was over. And he did that for so many years on NBC with those colorful pants, but in 2006, we're going to listen to some of those interviews he would do after the match was over. He caught up with Roger Federer in 2006 after the Wimbledon final. Here's Bud Collins with the interview.
Congratulations. Has this become an addiction?
I don't know. I mean, it's just fantastic, you know, that I was able again to play so well in the final, and especially against Rafael, you know, who I really have difficulty with playing against. And, you know, he came back very strong after that first set. So, I mean, it's another dream come true for me, and it's the fourth, so I'll try to go for five next year.
How important was the second set tiebreaker?
Oh, I think it was huge. You know, he was up not only the tiebreak, just to get back into the match, you know, and he served for the set. And I could turn it around, so I think that was maybe key to the match.
We said after Paris that Rafael was in your head, was he?
I don't know, a little bit maybe. I think we've had such good matches, you know, but I think the important thing is to keep sort of the motivation going, you know, not to be frustrated by losing. Even though I was so close, you know, and I was so excited with the Rome final, it was fantastic, over 5 hours of fantastic tennis. So coming to Paris, I was really excited. So I just had to make sure I get up for it one more time, you know, and say, okay, you know, he's maybe beaten me, but they were very close. So I was happy I could turn it around again.
Is this the best Roger Federer we've seen today?
Well, I think for an entire tournament. I think maybe last year, you know, it was different, you know, playing against against Andy, you know. So it's always hard to play against a lefty, you know, who I've never played against on grass. And but it was definitely the best Grand Slam tournament by
far. Was he the toughest of your three foes in the finals?
I don't think so. I think Andy was really dangerous that year when he, the second year around when I won. And he should have been up 2-1. The rain came and I got a little lucky and I played great in the end. But so I think maybe that was more difficult.
We don't look at you as lucky, Roger Federer. We look at you as a great champion. And this place is still Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
Well,
thank
thanks.
You very much.
All right, see you then.
That's good. Well, Roger.
But Collins always knew what to say there at the end of those interviews. This is Bud in 2005 after Wimbledon with Venus Williams.
Williams, you lived up to the name today. How did you get out of that?
I don't know. I just felt like today I couldn't get my best tennis out of me. But you know, Serena, you know, always sending me emails. She just said keep fighting, and just kept fighting. And sometimes I didn't know what was going to happen.
Sad news today. We lost a giant.
It's been more than 40 years since somebody saved a match point and won this championship.
Oh my God.
What were you thinking when it was match point?
You know, I just was thinking, okay, first serve in, and, you know, on the ground show, just keep your head down, stay down, and run them all down. And it worked.
She served for the match in the second set. You were up against it then. What were you thinking then?
Oh, my God, that game went so quick. I think she didn't get a point, or I won all four in a row, and then the tie break, I started to run away with it, then it got close, but you know, I was right back in, and then sometimes out, but then sometimes in, and next thing I know, it was over.
You came into this tournament being put down by the press, in decline, can't do it anymore. How did you react to that?
Well, my motto is I'm alive, so it means I can do anything, as long as I'm alive.
You were alive. You pulled your forehand and your serve together. Did that take some work?
You know, like I said, the main thing for me is to focus on my forehand and on my ground strokes as a stay down and my head down. When I get excited, sometimes that, you know, that's my weakness. And on my serve, obviously, I have a great serve. It's just all about executing at the right time.
Did you feel she was still dangerous after her injury timeout?
For sure. I mean, we went to 9-7 for sure. And at that point in a Wimbledon championship, you're going to give it all you have. And I knew she would. And I had to try to give a little bit more.
Well, little sister saved match points when she won the Australian Open against Sharapova, and now you've saved one. Is this up, 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 and higher, Venus?
I guess so. I'd like to win without a heart attack and going into cardiac arrest, but I guess if that's what it takes.
Well, you had what it takes.
Thanks.
The champion, Venus Ebony Star Williams. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. After beating Sharon.
Venus Williams with Bud Collins in 2005 after her Wimbledon win. If you have a remembrance of Bud Collins, you can call it in. We're hopefully going to get his wife, Anita Ruthlig Clausen, on today to remember him. But as we wait for her, let's go back and listen to our interview with Bud Collins from Christmas Eve of 2008. Here we go.
And today we're joined by, in my estimation, one of the greatest broadcasters ever to pick up a microphone, the great Bud Collins. Bud, how are you doing?
Well, Scott, that's a nice introduction. I appreciate it, and thank you. I'm doing fine. I'm in Florida right now, and as soon as I finish this, I'm going to take a swim.
Hey, well, that's a nice thing to do on Christmas Eve.
Yes, it is.
It certainly is. Well, Bud, I kind of want to start this interview back as far as we can go back, because I think a lot of people might be interested in this. What was your childhood like?
Well, it was a very nice childhood. I grew up in the small town. It was a small town then anyway, called Berea, outside of Cleveland, the home of Baldwin Wallace College. And, of course, we had the college fields to play on, and we had a wonderful school system in Berea. I hope they still do. Fine teachers. And I sort of stayed in Berea. I went to Baldwin Wallace College, and then I went into the Army and turned up in Boston to go to graduate school. Got a job with the Boston Herald as a sports writer. Moved on to the Globe, Boston Globe, in 1963. Been with them ever since, but 1963 was also a big year for me because I started doing television on the public station in Boston. In those days, it was called educational television. Now it's PBS. But we were the first, really, to do tennis fully, a whole tournament, match after match, day after day. A guy named Greg Harney was a marvelous producer, director. And it was only in Boston for a couple of years. But in 1968, PBS became national. And a fellow named Arthur Ashe, nobody had ever seen him on television. He'd had a few stories written about him. He came to Boston as a lieutenant in the U.S. Army to play in the U.S. Amateur Championships. And we had that on PBS. And that was a revelation to people to see this young black man playing tennis so well. And then 2 weeks later, he went to New York to play in the first U.S. Open. And he was seeded fifth, but Rod Laver was the favorite to win the tournament. However, Cliff Drysdale, who you know now is a wonderful television commentator, Cliff Drysdale upset Laver, opened the way for Ashe, and Ashe won the U.S. Open. And nobody will ever do that again, an amateur winning the amateur championship and the U.S. Open, because it's just too tough for an amateur. Anyway, after the Boston win by Ashe, I got a phone call from CBS, a guy at CBS who'd seen me on Channel 13 in New York, asking me if I'd be interested in doing the U.S. Open, first Open, and I did that with Jack Kramer, and that's when my life changed radically into doing more television than sometimes more newspaper work. But I didn't want to leave the newspaper work, and I think I covered a lot of, you'll be surprised at this, I covered boxing. That was my first beat.
Wow.
It was a strong sport in Boston in those days, in the 1950s. And I covered most of Muhammad Ali's big fights, including the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire in 1974. So that gives you pretty much a thumbnail of what I've been doing. And I'm still trying to do. I'm with ESPN now after 35 years with NBC. And I'm also with Tennis Channel.
Did you have any ill will when NBC and yourself parted ways?
Not a bit, because I'd had 35 fine years, and then they said, we want to see you on our station, so our network, I should say. So I wasn't unemployed very long.
What was covering the Rumble in the Jungle like?
Well, it was a tremendous experience because it was so weird. I went over twice to Zaire. I went over in September and for the fight which was scheduled, and then George Foreman, Ali's opponent and holding the heavyweight title, was cut in sparring. So I had to go back to the United States, and nobody believed that fight would ever come off because Mobutu, who was the dictator in Zaire, wouldn't let the fighters out of the country. They wanted to come home. They'd been there long enough. And so they reschedule it, and the rescheduling in October was during the annual rainy season. And people said that fight will never come off. It was an outdoor fight. And because of the rainy season, which will just wipe out any sporting activity during that time. Well, we got there for a second time. Didn't rain yet. Ali promised that it wouldn't rain until he'd won the title. And we'd heard a lot of boasting from Ali, who was a great guy. And sure enough, the rain held off until he knocked out Foreman in the eighth round. And this was another weird thing. The fight started at 3 in the morning, so it could get back to the East Coast of the United States at 10 p.m. the previous night. So as soon as he knocked out Foreman, we all went, the reporters went down to the press room and started typing madly. We weren't going to make too many deadlines, but I guess I got it the first edition of the Globe. And then we heard a noise. It was a thunderstorm. And before we knew it, the press room was flooded. And we got out by taking off our shoes and socks and carrying our typewriters, mind you, no computers yet, carrying our typewriters over our heads and getting out. And we found Ali at his villa, standing out in the yard, the rain dripping down, and he said, "I told you that Allah would not let it rain until I regained my championship." So it made a wonderful story.
What a great story that is. Now, Bud, one thing I want to ask you, because I can't think of anybody better to ask this of than you. What makes a good broadcaster?
You're just throwing those tough questions. I don't know what makes a good broadcaster. I think you have to have a distinctive voice, and I think I do. I think you want to be very well informed on what you're broadcasting, and I think you don't want to take yourself too seriously. After all, it's doing sports isn't Edward R. Murrow or something like that, or Cronkite. So you have to. I feel you have to have a little sense of humor. And not really take it too seriously, because sport is wonderful, but there are many more important things in our country.
Absolutely. Very well put. Now, speaking of not taking yourself too seriously, I have to ask this question. I'm sure you've been asked this many times, but one of the signatures of Bud Collins is the clothes.
Well, that's true.
The very loud clothes, the very loud way that you dress. Where did that all come about?
Well, it is a long story. It goes back to 1966 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just off Harvard Square. There's a tailor named Charlie Davidson, who's a fine friend of mine. And I came in there one day in 1966, and he said, "You look awful on television." I said, "What do you mean, Charlie?" And he said, "Well, you're wearing white trousers and a blue blazer, and you look like some guy at a yacht club." And he said, "I just happen to have some material. Just got in. And I'll make you a pair of trousers, and if you don't like them, I won't charge you for them. But you have to wear them." Now, this was a Madras red and white plaid, which you wouldn't look at it twice today. But in 1966, I looked at it and said, when he made them, I said, "Charlie, I can't wear those." And he said, "You promised." And my wife at the time said, "You can't wear those." I said, "Well, I promised Charlie." So there was a Davis Cup series in Cleveland, of all places, and I was covering that for the Globe. And as I entered the stands, I wished it had been rainy so that I could have worn a raincoat to cover those pants. But I started to walk up the grandstand to the press box, which was at the top. And as I walked, I heard whistles. And people screaming, "Oh, look at that, and that sort of thing, I thought, gosh, I wish I could just fall into a hole. But then I got up to the top and I sat down, took my seat, and I said, well, that was kind of fun. And so Charlie continues to be the guy who makes most of my trousers. Some are off the rack, very few, however. And usually what we do, my wife and I, my wife is a great woman at anything, but she has a sense of clothing, and wherever we go, we buy the fabric, and we bring it, if it's interesting, and we bring it back to Charlie, who makes the trousers. So he's made some from material from Bhutan, which is a Himalayan kingdom we visited once, and from Thailand, and from Zimbabwe when we covered Davis Cup there in 2000. Also some Aboriginal designs from Australia and Maori design when I covered the tournament in New Zealand. So that's how it goes, Scott. And some people think it's ridiculous and other people like it.
No, I think it's great. But this is not something that you would say wear in normal life. This is
and actually when I'm going around, people are always saying to me, well, where are your pants? And I say, gee, didn't I wear them today? And they say, I wear them on occasions. I have my Wimbledon trousers, which are strawberries, and they only get worn once a year. That's for the end final. And so it's a lot of fun. And Charlie Davidson, who is now 82 years old, is still tailoring, still making them up, and I hope he does for years.
That's great. Now, Bud, what would you consider to be the highlight of this career of yours?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think that certainly Arthur Ashe winning that U.S. Open in 1968, and when he won the U.S. Amateur 2 weeks prior to that in Boston, with PBS we had lots of time for interviews, and that was a time of Black Power and Black Panthers and so on, and so I had to ask him, how does that fit into your life? And of course he was a lieutenant in the Army. He couldn't say much about it. He said, I just have to follow orders in the Army, and I can't be political. And then I asked him, how does it feel to belong to play at a club? It was Longwood Cricket Club in Boston with grass courts. How does it feel to play at a club which would never allow you as a member? And he said, well, I disapprove, of course, of that status, and it has changed since then. But he said, I have to go where the game is played. And that was a good answer. I think Ali and Zaire was another wonderful moment. But they've been so lucky, so many. I've been very lucky. Scott, I covered the war in Vietnam for a while, and I got out of that. I was scared every minute, and I've had some terrific assignments.
Has there ever been a low point where you just considered, I don't like what I'm doing?
Well, I always have those low points every once in a while, saying, people say to me, why don't you retire? And I have thought about that for a time, and I thought, well, what would I do? So the low points vanish pretty quickly, but I think that the United States is in a crisis now, and I'm just hoping that Mr. Obama can pull us out. Well, he needs a lot of help to do it. So I think right now we're all in a low point, or pretty much in a low point. I'm lucky to have a job, and I feel grateful about that, but this country's in a lot of trouble. I think we have the brains to get out of it, but we have to overcome a lot of damage.
Absolutely. But, being that it is Christmas Eve, and you are so very kind to join us on this Christmas Eve morning, do you have a memorable Christmas moment that sticks out in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you this. In Berea now, the house where I live has been demolished, and the area is part of the Baldwin Wallace campus. And if you walk down Graham Street, where I lived, you will see about six wonderful-looking Christmas trees, only they're much bigger. Well, every year when we had Christmas, my father would get a tree that could be planted on the 26th of December. So he planted these trees, and they're a silent memorial to him and my mother, and I get very emotional when I walk alongside those trees because they represent childhood Christmases, which were always very good. Even during the Depression, my father was out of work for a while, but they scrambled, and my mother and father, and made it a wonderful childhood.
How often do you get back to Ohio?
Not very often. Not very often at all. The last time was in 2007 when I was asked to do the commencement speech at Baldwin Wallace. I was very honored by President Dick Durst. And it was an interesting time, though, because I got booed in many parts of that speech because I said we are living in an age of anxiety. I said anxiety, but also amnesia. I said we don't get history, and we disregard history. I was in Vietnam, and I said, well, thank goodness this will never happen again. And here we are in two wars. And so when I said that, though, I guess Ohio wasn't going the way that it finally went in 2008, and I talked about huge corporate salaries and how we need better public education. So I got a few hisses and a few boos, and it upset my wife. And I said, come on, don't be upset. I had to say those things, and I've been booed before.
How will you spend Christmas this year, Bud?
Well, we're spending Christmas here in Longboat Key, Florida, where I've been spending Christmas every year since 1979. And my wife and I, we have three children with us. And that's how we're not all the children, but three of them. And we will have a swim. We may hit some tennis balls. We'll take a walk on the beach. And we'll have a nice dinner.
That'll be great. Bud, have you ever thought of an epitaph, how you'd like to be remembered?
Oh, gee, that's a great question. An epitaph. Well, gee. My wife just said in the background she wants a copy of this interview, and I know you'll supply it for her. An epitaph. Well, he tried hard and enjoyed what he did and made quite a few people happy.
Well, Bud, you certainly have made me happy on many occasions. I love the way you dress. I love the way you commentate.
And we certainly thank Bud Collins for giving us that interview back in 2008, Christmas Eve of 2008. Here's how ESPN paid tribute to the late Bud Collins.
Good afternoon, Bud Collins, along with Jack Kramer, with you at Forest Hills, where we're reaching the climax of an extraordinary event in tennis, the first U.S. Open.
Well, I fell in love with tennis a long time ago. Nobody wanted to cover tennis, and that's where I got a break.
Wherever tennis has been around the world, Bud Collins has been there.
His passion for the game was second to none.
I haven't been too shy in my job, and I've been so lucky to go around the world often to cover tennis.
He was so far ahead of his time in understanding that obviously tennis was a great game, but that tennis also needed to be entertaining and make the personalities and the players entertaining.
Think of the phrases he has coined that will never be equaled. Fräulein forehand for Stephanie Graf, the pearl of the pampas for Gabriela Sabatini, the Lithuanian lion Vytas Gerulaitis. They go on and on and on. He has changed the vernacular of this sport.
Arriba Ecuador, Bombardero.
Thank you.
Take a look at the face of a champion. This is not the shower you need, so go into a very well-earned shower.
I thought, have some fun. I have people come up to me at the U.S. Open and say, can I buy your pants? And I say, no, they're not for sale.
He could be the only person in the world that can make the clothes that he wears look good, wear it in style, and he backs it up with an incredible mind and a sharp wit.
Mats, I want to check your Swedish passport, the way you played some of those points.
I'm proud of myself for making tennis live.
think it's absolutely fitting that this place will be forever known as the Bud Collins Media Center.
I've been lucky in covering tennis. I think that I've made a place in there that nobody is going to equal. That really makes me feel good.
And again, Bud Collins passed away last Friday at the age of 86. This is an interesting piece of audio tape. This is an analysis that Bud Collins gave on the rivalry between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. Listen to this.
Bud Collins joins me now. What a display from Federer. What do you make of the tears? It was 4 years ago with Rod Laver standing there presenting him with the winner's trophy that Federer had emotional. Different sorts of tears tonight.
Yes, because he was the victor then, but we found out that the rain, R-E-I-G-N, from Spain has fallen on this concrete plain right here in Melbourne and placed two great players, Chris, but the rectangle was not big enough for two. One guy, Rafa, came through. And rivalries now, Pete Sampras wasn't going to hire a defense lawyer or anything like that, but he has a defender in Rafa because he still has the record of 14 major championships, and that may go on for a while because the next stop in majors is Paris. They'll play probably before that, probably in Rome. But rivalries have been really what the game has always needed and has had. The first rivalry, really, that excited Americans about tennis was Big Bill Tilden from Philadelphia and Little Bill Johnston from San Francisco. They played in six U.S. finals, Tilden winning five. And that really turned on people to tennis at Forest Hills. We've had some wonderful rivalries. Martina Navratilova getting ahead of Chris Evert just a little bit, 37-33. Sampras himself, 20-14 over Agassi. John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg, seven apiece. And now we have this tremendous rivalry that it's tough on Federer. It's really going to be tough, Chris.
You saw him fighting back tears again as they posed for the trophy. This is the Nadal trademark, taking a bite out of another big trophy. The first Spaniard to win this title down under it. But I have to ask you, you know, people have talked about, you know, Federer being the greatest player of all time. Rafa seems certain he'll catch the 14 and pass it, but can he be considered the greatest of all time if he's outplayed by a rival in his prime?
I don't think so. I don't think so. He has a long career ahead of him, but he can't beat Nadal. His backyard, Wimbledon, was stolen from him by Nadal. Now, what about this guy? He's only 22. He might be the one to pass Sampras if it happens.
Well, here are some numbers, Bud. You're right. At 22, he's got three quarters of the career slam and has to be considered, obviously, a contender at the U.S. Open, beaten by Andy Murray in the semifinals last year. Rafa, all of a sudden, if you project forward and he can continue to win majors on the hard courts and back up a Wimbledon, all of a sudden he becomes a contender for the greatest of all time title. Huh?
It took Sampras from 1990 to 2002 to rack up those 14. Now, Federer has come very close in only 7 years. But what would you say? Federer might not win another major.
And that was from 2009, again, paying tribute to Bud Collins this hour, a legendary tennis broadcaster. Now, does anybody know where Bud Collins was born? He was born in Ohio, but do you know where he was born? I think I might have said the wrong name earlier on. Let's see here. If I did, I did. I said the right name. 740-383-9944. Here's a question for you. Bud Collins was born in a city in Ohio. Two other famous people who I have on this station were born in that same city. Name the three people and the city. If you do, I will give you your choice. You can have a Jags mug. You can have two free bowling games to Buckeye Lanes for a group of four. You can have a To Die For cupcake. You can have a gift card for $10 to Rosa and Rocco's. You can have a gift card to Pesto's. But the question on the table is, name the city where legendary broadcaster Bud Collins, tennis broadcaster Bud Collins, was born. And then tell me the two other famous people, Ohioans, who went on to national acclaim, who have both been on this station, also were from that same Ohio city. What an exodus that must have been. One of them is still living. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. Give me a ring. And don't forget, tomorrow, Charles Grodin, who is always a very interesting guest, to say the least, be here tomorrow, Wednesday, March the 9th at 1:10 p.m. I was going to try to find a little clip of Charles Grodin, because every time he's on, holy mackerel. Let's see here. Here's a little clip of Charles Grodin on David Letterman. Remember, Charles Grodin on this show tomorrow, March the 9th at 1:10 p.m. Hold on, we might be getting a call here. This will be interesting. Hey, you're live on WWGH Radio. Go ahead.
Was that Lima, Ohio, where he's born?
That is Lima, Ohio. Do you know the other two famous people from Lima?
Was that Phyllis Diller and Hugh Downs?
You got it.
I got it, huh?
You got it. What prize do you want?
What you got?
We got $10 to Rosa and Rocco's. We've got Pesto's. We've got a To Die For cupcake. We've got two free bowling games for a group of four to Buckeye Lanes. We've got a Jags mug. We've got a $100 pass to have your air conditioner or heater repaired from CRT.
Oh, let's try Pesto's.
Pesto's. Now, you like tennis, right?
Yes.
What's your memories of Bud Collins?
Oh, I just remember his pants.
That's all you remember about him?
Well, he was a good broadcaster, interviewer.
He was. Hopefully we'll hear from his wife at some point.
Okay.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's right. It was Lima, Ohio, and the other two famous people who were born there, Phyllis Diller, Hugh Downs, both regular guests on this program, and we appreciate that. We were supposed to be joined today by Anita Ruthling Claussen, who is the wife of Bud Collins. I might try to give her another call here while you listen to this clip of Charles Grodin. Remember, Charles Grodin live on this show tomorrow, March the 9th at 1:10 p.m. But here's Charles Grodin.
I didn't realize you were a...
Of course you did. I've been on this show for years telling you this.
The right kind of people. What's this all about, the right kind of people?
The right kind of people is about a Fifth Avenue co-op board in New York. Co-op board is where you have to go and apply to live in the building.
Yeah, it's hell. It's just
And they look you over, and it's very hard. There's an article in the paper today, actually, about how difficult it is. A person like you, for example, would never get in.
I got in, but I know what you mean.
No, I got in. You're in a co-op building?
Yes,
I'm
in.
You went in front of a co-op board and you're in.
Yes, and I'm in.
Are you serious?
Yes, and a revered member of the cooperative.
What are you on the east or west side?
I'm downtown.
No.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
No, I'm talking about Fifth Avenue in the 70s.
Oh, I'd have no interest in that.
You would never get in.
Yeah, I'd get in.
No, I'll tell you why you wouldn't get in.
No, they wouldn't get in. I wouldn't want them in. I don't want them in that building.
No, I'm talking about the Park View on Fifth Avenue, right next door to Klaus von Bülow's building. And you would not get in, and I'll tell you why.
They let Klaus von Bülow in, and I can't get in?
Right.
That's awful.
Well, no, here's the reason. You know, the people would say about you, you know, he's very funny on television. Yeah. He looks like a very jolly guy and all this stuff. Yeah. But if you're ever alone in an elevator with him, which I've never been with you, thank God, but I have crossed your path backstage, and it's one of the most chilling experiences.
Remember, Charles Grodin on this show tomorrow at 1 10 p.m. Now, I just got a message from our host here, who does a show every Tuesday and Thursday morning from 9, 10 a.m. till 10 a.m., Adam the Computer Guy, who I think he Googled this. He was trying to get the answer right on the Bud Collins question. He Googled Bud Collins. Bud Collins was born June 17th, 1929 in Lima, Ohio. That's correct. He knew Phyllis Diller was born in Lima. I think he Googled that too. But then he said Hugh Downs was born in Akron. Now see, this is why you can't Google everything. Because Hugh Downs was born in Lima. Trust me. I've interviewed Hugh Downs a lot, and he was born in Lima. Now, Google does say, Wikipedia does say, that Hugh Downs was born in Akron. But Hugh was actually born in Lima. So, there you go. See, Adam, sometimes you have to just know that stuff. Any questions or remembrances of Bud Collins, give us a call, 740-383-9944. And we're going to try to get Anita Ruthling-Clausen, Bud Collins' widow, on tomorrow. She was supposed to be on today, but we'll try to get her on tomorrow during the 12 o'clock hour so we can pay tribute to Bud Collins. And we might also try to get in touch with Bud's... He just sent me the Wikipedia. I understand, Adam. I know you're out there listening. The Wikipedia is not correct. But Robbie Lacey, who was the stepson, Bud Collins had a couple stepchildren, but Robbie Lacey was the stepson of Bud Collins. Maybe we'll get him on tomorrow too. And maybe Don Dell. Don Dell was Bud's broadcast partner for many years, right along with Dick Enberg. So we'll try to get all of them on tomorrow so we can have our proper tribute to the legendary Bud Collins. I love that man's pants. You know, and it wasn't just his pants. He wore very colorful shirts. He wore very colorful bow ties. He was just a very interesting guy. By the way, here's Bud Collins' take. Oops, maybe if I can get this right. Here is Bud Collins' take on, let's see here, if I can get this right, Bud Collins' take on Andre Agassi.
I first saw Andre Agassi, he was about 15 years old. He came to a place called the Colony Beach and Tennis Resort, Longboat Key, Florida. That's where Nick Bollettieri got his start. And he played an exhibition for the guests against Chip Hooper. And he was a friendly little guy, and you could see this guy can hit the ball. And Bollettieri had told me about him and said, now you got to be there when he's playing. He said, don't go swimming, just be there when he's playing an exhibition for the guests. And he was just sensational. And I thought, this kid is going to make it. I really felt, I don't feel that way about many people. The first time I saw Billie Jean King, I felt that way, and I felt that way about Andre. But it didn't take a genius to see that.
Bud Collins on Andre Agassi. I don't think he was far off on that. Who do you think is the greatest tennis player of all time? Those out there who watch tennis, 740-383-9944. Who is the greatest tennis player of all time? Adam is now sending me messages that the Internet Movie Database apparently also had it wrong. And he's telling me that he's telling me the Internet Movie Database is never wrong. Adam, it's wrong. I'm sorry to break it to you. The Internet Movie Database on this one is not right. So you're going to have to deal with it, I guess. So let's see here. Who's the greatest tennis player of all time? 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. Give me a ring, and we will get you up on the air. I don't know who the greatest tennis player of all time is. Maybe Arthur Ashe. People forget Arthur Ashe because he's been gone for such a long time. I believe he died of AIDS, if I'm not mistaken. But Arthur Ashe was certainly something in his day. There's no doubt about that. Okay, let's go and take another little profile of Bud Collins here.
Tennis has been a passion of mine for a long time. But purely by accident did I become a tennis-employed person, I guess you might say, and doing television and radio.
Federer had emotional, different sorts of tears tonight.
Yes, because he was the victor then, but we found out that the rain, R-I-G-N, from Spain has fallen on this concrete plain right here in Melbourne.
Ed Costello at the Herald assigned me when I was a copy boy. I was working part-time while I went to BU. And I found out that nobody else on the staff wanted to cover tennis. It was very unpopular with my colleagues. So he said, well, you go out and cover an event called the Massachusetts Women's Championships. He said, now don't question me. You're new on this and you just have to do what I tell you to do. But I was secretly thrilled.
So we're right into a third set and we don't know what's going to happen. I think we're going to see Margaret trying a lot more lobs against Rosie.
Well, Margaret Court going for that grand slam. We're going to show you the tape now going into the third set.
Tennis shots. One shot I really remember is 1984 at the U.S. Open. Yvonne Lendl is playing against Pat Cash. And Lendl was facing match point.
Just under 3.5 hours these two have been going at one another.
And Cash, who was a great volleyer, came to the net, angled a volley off to Lendl's right, and Lendl just ran, and lifted a topspin lob over Cash's head, landing on the far baseline. He saved the match point, and he won the match. People ask me who the most influential people were in tennis. I always think of Billie Jean King, because not just a great influence in women's tennis, but in tennis as a whole, and sport as a whole. She's a pretty peppery person, and she realizes these responsibilities, and she goes at it full force. Arthur Ashe was a great influence in many ways because he was interested in education as well as tennis. Arthur had been trying to go to South Africa, and he was outspoken on the subject of apartheid. People were so grateful to see Arthur, to see a world-class athlete. Arthur had a great effect on getting black kids into the game, and I think the Williams sisters, who are now on top of the game, were encouraged by his success. If you've been around tennis for any length of time, you can see that it's not the same game that people are playing now. I mean, the scoring is the same, the court is the same size, but technology has taken over. There was more variety to the game when we had the wooden racket. You won't see a player today with the genius of John McEnroe. He shows the variety that we don't get from many other players, but I wonder what kind of a player would he be as attractive with the high-tech racket? I don't know. I enjoy the game, and I want to see what comes next. This year was Kim Clijsters, played 7 matches before the U.S. Open and won it, unseeded. And brings her baby out to the court to show everybody. That was a joyful time. And so that's what keeps me coming back for the good stories.
Bud Collins, gone at the age of 86 last Friday. Hopefully we'll have his wife on tomorrow. Stay tuned to WWGH Radio. This is Scott Spears for today, heading for the dugout.
But if you ask, do I wish throughout the course of the entire situation that we would have made some difference?